Okay, great. So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's March 15th, 2017. And as you know, if you've been here before, but in general, we're exploring mindfulness of relationships, or exploring relationships more generally as both a field of practice this year and a support for practice. And that brings up a lot of material. And I hope to look at it with you through the lens of Buddha Dharma, also informed by an awareness of our embodied nature in relationship as animals, social mammals, big monkeys, who've been shaped by millions of years of evolution, 600 plus roughly 600 million years or so of evolution of the nervous system, and in especially the last several million years, arguably the primary adaptation of the evolving human species was to group living, was to operating successfully, surviving successfully within small bands while interacting often, sometimes aggressively, with other small bands. So it's in that kind of grounded way that I hope to explore things with you this year. One thing that I'd like to kind of open up to today is this consciousness in relationship of the impermanence of the other person. We speak often, or the Buddha emphasized tremendously, insight into impermanence. The impermanence of experience, the impermanence of most of the material universe. And through training, through meditative training and through other forms of training, we develop a greater granularity of mindfulness and real time and real space recognition of changing, including the changing of the witnessing of the changing, right? The changing of the experiencing of the changing. And as part of that, there is, of course, a mindfulness of the changingness of other people. And under the general heading of that topic, our struggles and suffering sometimes when we try to hold back the river or hold back the tide of changes in the other person, trying to sort of resist our children growing up and growing out. Also coming to terms with, inevitably, the impermanence of the body of those we care about dearly, and the way that that affects us, both as we deal with immediate losses and also more generally how we cope with and practice with anticipated losses or the knowledge eventually of loss, which can sometimes affect us in such a way that we don't want to invest our love because eventually that vehicle, that boat will sink. Right, in some sense. And so how do you come to terms with that? So I want to kind of open it up with you with a sort of a couple personal stories and some teaching from the Buddha and then kind of see what you think about it. My purpose here is not to traumatize anyone. So it's kind of a trigger alert. We're talking about impermanence, including impermanence of those we love, you know. And I won't get all morbid. It actually is really interesting that one of the hallmark features of Buddhism and why for me personally, I keep being redrawn to it because for me it's a radical teaching, which the root of the word radical is root. It goes right to the root of things. That the Buddha's teaching is that we suffer because we look for sources of happiness in the wrong places. We try to make ourselves and even make other people happy through methods that are well-intended and understandable, but basically doomed to fail. And paradoxically, it's when we really embrace, and it's through the radical embrace of impermanence that we come to that which is reliable, that which doesn't change, a kind of fundamental stillness, or that which is unconditioned outside of the frame of endless conditioned changes. See the paradox? It's really weird. We give up holding on to what we think is stable but really isn't, go through the freak out of the elevator dropping out beneath our floor of groundlessness, including kind of existential groundlessness, and then through that, we find a peaceful stability. What? Okay. So I want to kind of explore some of that with you. And I want to start by just personally, recently I found out about a week ago that my father's best friend, and in many ways the coolest guy, I thought, amongst my parents' loser friends when I was a kid, he was a cool guy. And he's one of those people who, when you're 12 years old or 10 years old, actually talks with you like you're a real person. You know, and you remember that if you're 6 years old or 4 years old or 14 years old. The person is actually talking with you like you're a real person and back and forth. And he's willing to receive what you say and a real back and forth. The name, Jim. And I found out that Jim had passed away mid-January. So I found out about 2 months after the fact. And there was a lot about that that touched me, kind of the passing of my father's generation. My father died about a year and a half ago, you might know, and my mom died about 10 years before that. And his whole generation is pretty much gone. He was almost 97 when he died, so you know, a lot of people go with you. Jim was in his mid-90s as well. And it really touched me, this sense that others around us are falling leaves, just like us. Eventually, the leaf falls off the tree. And by all accounts, it was a relatively peaceful passing. He had come to the end of a long, rich life. He survived his wife by about 10 years. And what touched me about it, in addition to the normal process of grief and loss, the Buddha made a distinction, you may know, between, he called it the first and the second dart of life. The first dart is unavoidable, inevitable, natural, physical discomfort, and I think we could reasonably add emotional, social discomfort as well, such as the first dart of losing those we care about. I really cared about Jim. I maintained a long relationship with him. He was good to me. We connected. He was sad that my father passed away. So there's a natural first dart there. But then there are also, of course, the second darts we throw if we really get into our reactions or we start fueling negativity or spirals of conflict with other people. Those are the second darts that are primary sources of our suffering, particularly the suffering we inflict upon ourselves, in a sense, volitionally. So I mainly was in the first dart, you know, with Jim. And one of the things that struck me was how there could be people in our life that have already passed away, but we just don't know it. And I don't mean that morbidly, but just getting real about it. I've mentioned that you can go to these websites that are very authoritative about the world's population, and sort of like three disks are twirling. It's like numbers are changing in three windows, and there's the total net population that's changing really quickly. Then there's the births, which is changing even faster, and then there's the deaths that are also changing continuously, even if a little bit more slowly. I was watching one of the great classics, Jack Reacher, Tom Cruise, last night with my wife, and he made the point that in America, something like 7,000 people die every day. Some number like that, ballpark probably. Who can trust Tom Cruise? But anyway, I figured the line was accurate. So my point about all that is just to realize that this process is going on around us. We may not even be aware of it. Obviously, around the world, you know, separate, distinct from people that we might know, like Jim for me, people are unfortunately dying all the time, and often tragically, often needlessly, often unfortunately, often terribly. And that's happening. And so how do we be mindful of it without growing numb to it or feeling overwhelmed by it, or being unwilling to actually invest in others that we might lose, who we might actually lose, including suddenly? And so I want to share with you a little teaching from one of my favorite monks, Bhikkhu Anālayo. He wrote the book Satipatthana, which is the Pali for Foundations of Mindfulness or Establishments of Mindfulness, that I brought in multiple times, blue cover, excellent book. And this piece is from a talk, a conversation he gave that you can access through the newsletter for the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, a really high quality center. And he reflects here about death. And so I'm just going to read a little short passage to you. He says in this particular collection of teachings, the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha checks to see how some monks are doing recollection of death. That's a mindfulness practice among many others, recollection of death. And he finds that they're doing it in a way that he does not consider to be sufficiently diligent. Bad monks. No. Okay. These monks say things like they might pass away in a couple of days, and before that, they should really practice. That's their interpretation of recollection of mortality. Right? Mortality is coming our way eventually. We better get it together before we run out of runway. And the Buddha says, well, that's not really what I think you ought to do. The right way to practice, instead, they should bring the awareness of their own mortality right into the present moment. And I'm going to build on that to suggest a recognition of the mortality of everything right into the present moment. Like, what's it like to be in real-time awareness that your sweetheart or your child or your parent or your friend or your neighbor or someone whose face you see on a website coming to us from the other side of the world, you know, things are impermanent and things could change at any moment. And to find a way to be with that that's not morbid or freaked out. Buddha says he recommends two modes: being aware that this breath might be your last breath, and being aware that each bite of food might be your last bite of food. And then he goes on to say, and I'll bring in this part, that this contemplation of death as a very dramatic form of impermanence actually takes us in to the cultivation of insight into that which is unconditioned and not subject to old age, disease, and death, not subject to arising and passing away. And there's some way in which I have found that an awareness of the inevitable passing away of those around you, in a weird kind of way, takes us into the continuity of livingness altogether. We start having more of a sense that, yes, wave after wave comes and goes. And somehow that takes us into more of a sense of the abidingness of ocean, of relatedness altogether. Relationships change. Relatedness does not change. Relatedness, in a sense, is a permanent fact of reality. Right? And is therefore an opportunity for refuge, the ongoingness of relatedness. Forms do pass away. Patternings of various kinds of reality are like eddies in the stream. They come, they arise, and then they swirl and disperse. But that which is being patterned, reality altogether, itself is permanent. Itself doesn't change. And as a couple of practices of that, just to offer it, as I've mentioned in here, I had two friends when they would say, see ya, they were a couple. And when they would part in the morning, bye-bye, honey, or see ya, or kiss goodbye, something like that, they would actually take a beat, half a breath maybe, and let it really land, the uncertainty that they would ever see each other again. Not morbidly, not, oh, don't go, but more like, well, it's really true. It's kind of bare, vulnerable receptivity to reality, which then paradoxically helps you feel completely strong and at peace because you've already integrated the worst that can possibly happen. You're already there with it. It's already included. It's already included in your contemplation of reality altogether. Whoa, you might pass away. So I want to mention maybe one or two other things and then see what your own reflections are about this, how you practice with this yourself. Not so much practicing with a particular loss. Hopefully we'll have a chance to explore that at some point. But more generally, how you come to terms with and how does it affect you to realize that those around you are passing away as well. I was talking with a friend of mine at lunch today, who's in a She's 10 years into a marriage she came into late in life. She's in her early 70s. And her marriage is not perfect, and because I'm a therapist, she tells me her story, even though we're friends. I try not to therapize too much. On the other hand, it's really clear to me, and I said to her, you're going to stay married till the end of your life. And she went, yeah, I know. And I could have said, and I know it, I feel it with my wife, been married now 35 plus years, one of us is going to bury the other one. Unless something happens that takes us both out at the same time. And that's just a knowing. You're with someone and you look at them and you know that either they're going to hold your hand in the final minutes or you're going to hold theirs, hopefully. And it's so touching, isn't it? It really touches you. And it can feel crushing, but when we actually don't try to defend against that truth, you know. In a sense, the Buddha teaches a kind of defenselessness that's the most profound strength. When we're not defended, when we're defenseless against that truth, suddenly we feel at peace and at one. And of course, it draws us naturally, as I'm sure you're thinking, into a great appreciation for the beauty and the preciousness of who's with you right now, and a willingness to just lighten up about so much, speaking personally, judgmentalism and, you know, micro complaints. I can't believe she puts dishes into the sink on top of cups rather than stacking the plates so you can actually stack the plates. Can you believe that? So when you are aware, oh my goodness, this really precious being who's put up with so much of my crud over the years could pass away just like that. And she doesn't want to. She wants to see her grandchildren who have not yet arrived. They don't even seem like they're on the way yet. Come on, kids, get to it. And yet, you just realize, wow, what am I doing in my mind? You know, there's a sense of appreciation of the preciousness of the other person that comes in part from the recognition of their fragility, the undefended recognition of that. So last, just to kind of finish on that point, it's interesting to ask ourselves, particularly in terms of, you know, these sort of patterns of grievance or entanglement we have with people, where we resent things or we're kind of grumpy about something that's happened. And yes, it's utterly true, to protect our own needs, we have rights, especially if one tends to displace one's needs. It's important to really claim one's rights, healthy entitlement. All that said, if we look at that relationship with someone, or we look at that person that we have a complaint about, or we're outraged even about, or we're caught up in some kind of struggle, maybe who's right, some positionality, or some squabble with a neighbor about something, what happens when we look at that other person, or look at that situation through the lens, the undefended bodily knowing of the inevitable death of that other person eventually, and the impact on those who love that person or care about that person, work with that person, depend on that person, the ripple effects of that. You know, does something shift when we look at them through that lens? Doesn't mean we become a doormat or just toss away our rights, but what shifts when we see them in that way and we bring that holistic, undefended recognition of the truth into the immediacy of our relationship with that other person? All righty. More kids are being born every day than people are passing away. Of course, that's adding to population, but we won't go there. Anyway, so what do you make of all that? What do you think about all that? Right.
For me, it's just...
Do you mind speaking up a little bit? I can tell already you're going to say something great, and I want everyone to hear it. Really.
Just for me, it's acceptance.
Yeah.
Yeah, just acceptance. I live with an aunt of mine in Strawberry, and I help take care of her, and she's an elder. And so I know that she's towards the end.
Yeah.
And so rather than wait for that moment to happen when she passes, I've already started accepting the fact that she's going to leave us or leave me.
Yeah.
And she's going to go away.
Yeah.
And so I'm aware of that. I really am aware of that. And being present outside of this room, that I need to start letting go. And it's okay. It's okay. And I'm good with it.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And I could say for myself, just right here in the immediacy of it all, you were helping me realize that others will have others who will pass away. And that's part of what they're carrying, what you're carrying. And as I be with you here, I can realize through you there are those in your own life who, you know, who will pass away. And that changes how we are with the person right in front of us if we're aware that in their life as well, leaves are falling. Yeah.
You know, when I leave my boat in the morning, I always be sure my cat has enough food and enough water.
Because?
Because.
Yeah.
He may have to go for a while until someone comes over to wonder why I haven't been there.
Yeah.
On Sunday, I went to a funeral. I live in a small community in Sausalito, and a longtime friend and member of the community died on Friday, and we had her funeral on Sunday. And it was in a chapel right at the beginning of Tennessee Valley. If folks know that area, there's a crematorium just as you get into Tennessee Valley. And that's where we had a very, very darling ceremony of many members of the community there, many family, for her and for everyone else, really. You know, I wrote in a poem that rebirth is for the living. Well, so is the funeral. So I stayed there for a while, about an hour and a half, and I decided to go. It was enough. And I went on my normal walk down Tennessee Valley, which is almost every day or every other day. And I went right from the funeral to Tennessee Valley's beauty. It was a beautiful day. The birds, the animals, a coyote, even humans. And I said, as I was walking, she did pass away. But luckily, or the way it is, not everything passes away at once, yet.
Thank you. Yeah, please.
So the importance of the other people has been really on my mind today. I spent the day filing digital copies of old photos. So I was put back into the space of relating, seeing memories of people who have gone through the transition of seeing them, the old and the older and the older than not here. Also seeing myself, that the person I was with the little kids and my little kids, we aren't that anymore. The world is not that anymore. I got this really big feeling of, well, I'm now in the position that, you know, that they were in 20 years ago. My kids are in the position that I was in 20 years ago. And it's almost like the weavings in a, like some threads are going down and other threads are coming up. Very strong feeling that the tapestry is still there.
Yeah.
But all of this change is coming, you know, that everything really is and permanent. It did give me a feeling of sadness, but also just a survey confidence, a feeling of peacefulness that, you know, life is going to go on.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Great. In the back?
Yeah, I want to ask, if someone makes you really angry, and
say what?
I said, if someone really makes you very angry, and is that what you're saying is we should think one day that person is going to die so that we will be more forgiving of their present moment behavior?
Well, it's a little tricky. Well, so I wouldn't say should, first off. You know, it's like you find out for yourself what's true. And I also personally think that it's really important to honor what's true about our anger. or what's valid or a teaching in our anger? What should we stand up for that maybe our anger is telling us? Sometimes I think we do get angry about stupid stuff. I mean, I do. And when I replay it, I realize that was dumb. I didn't need to do that. It didn't add value. Yes, I understand I was triggered, whatever, but okay. But often when we're angry about something with another person, there's something to look at to try to help be better in our relationship or to find a way to talk about. So I want to respect that. And I personally think it's important that we especially do that with regard to people whose anger has historically been delegitimized by people in power, people in charge, such as women, for example. So I'm particularly thoughtful about, or members of various social groups, social class, all different kinds of factors. So I'm particularly careful about not wanting to undermine the legitimacy or authority of a person's anger. All that said, the Buddha's line about getting angry at others is that it's like throwing hot coals with bare hands. Both people get burned. And it really helped me deal with my own temper and so forth when I started to reframe anger as an affliction on me. Because of the four kinds of negative, quote unquote, emotion, sadness, fear, shame, and anger, they're on a spectrum. Sadness, fear, shame / inadequacy are pretty unpleasant. But there's something about the rush of anger, which often comes with a lot of righteousness, that feels pretty good, at least in the moment. You know, the Buddha also used the metaphor anger with its honeyed tip and poisoned barb to us, right? So that was helpful to me as a way of looking at anger. So what I'm just offering here is a kind of personal reflection that when I think of people in my own life today that I have a grievance with, I feel hurt by, I feel mistreated by, I feel there's an injustice maybe. Or maybe I just don't know why my wife doesn't put dishes the right way or something, you know what I mean? Or even, frankly, I've started doing it politically. I'll spare you my own personal politics, but when I think about leaders or people of various kinds who I'm bothered about, I notice that when I contemplate the reality of their inevitable passing away and how other people might feel about that, it's not that I give them a pass, but that I don't feel so disturbed by it myself. That's kind of what I'm getting at. And so in the spirit of the Buddha, who always emphasized, see for yourself, see what works and what doesn't work. That's the frame in which I'm offering this right now myself. Is that okay? Great. Yeah, thank you. Great, please. Yeah. You're nominating her, or did you have something too?
We both started speaking at the same
time. Oh, okay. All right. Okay, great. We'll start here, then we'll go there. Great, thank you.
Well,
all right.
I sometimes think about people, but then often it's like the earth, like, for example, all the coral, and it's passing, or it's like it starts kind of coming into a position of that acceptance and or the inevitability, and I don't really know how to translate that.
Yeah. Does it bother you that the coral, let's say, is dying due to global warming?
Yes, that sort of thing.
So what are you saying about that? It bothers you?
It bothers me, and this kind of accepting kind of feeling, I don't really accept it.
Yeah.
So I don't really, but at the same time, I don't have a power to intercept on very many levels. That kind of mourning or that kind of letting go.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting intersection of practice that it comes up again and again and again. What is that healthy sweet spot of equanimity and compassion, in a sense? Acceptance, seeing squarely the horror that is true, let's say, or the sad thing that is true, while also being vigorous and resolute. And to quote two other words in the Buddha, ardent, heartfelt, and mindful, right? Resolute, diligent, ardent and mindful in how we deal with that social injustice or that issue, or how we, you know, are trying to do the best we can to improve the quality of care our aunt or father, let's say, is getting in their last months, right? How do we pull those both together, right? Right? You're getting at that. Do you have a suggestion for us, or how do you do that yourself?
Well, I mean, it feels a little bit about like a person who's dying. It's how do you turn it back in a way? Some of it goes way out of my position.
I think a lot of it shows up for me, and also I think for people I read or are teachers, it's this combination of you know, peace and strength. There is a kind of at-peaceness that recognizes the truth of it and our limits of our power, while at the same time, we do the best we can each day. And maybe the best we can do is to bear witness to it, right? Or maybe the best we can do is be a little more thoughtful about not wasting power in its that contribution to global warming. Or we're a little more receptive when people come door to door looking for some money for environmental causes, maybe. Whatever it might be, you know, it's that place where, and weirdly, I find that when we know we've done what we can, what in our integrity system feels like that's what I can do amidst everything else I'm trying to do, it also helps us be more peaceful with it. I find, yeah. Ooh, well, first you, then I'm bouncing around, but sure, first
you.
Yeah, great, and then you, okay? Great, yeah.
So, yes, a former teacher that I had was also a hospice worker, and she would, in the final hours, work with her patients, and she would go through kind of an exercise with them, and she would say, can you forgive everyone for everything? And there would be so much material there, but then it would end with including yourself. And that was just such an amazing, amazing process. And she said people who were able to truly get to that died so incredibly peacefully. Mm. And people who weren't, it was like a struggle. So there's that expression, people die like they live. And so if people live fighting, they kind of like die fighting. And then if people are able to live relatively peacefully, they tend to die more relatively peacefully. So that's something I try to kind of remember in my life of like we're saying, we don't know if we have the next breath. So from time to time, I try to kind of stay conscious about, you know, am I forgiving everyone for everything, including myself? It's just kind of a nice time-to-time inventory to take.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, and not wanting to kind of bring the karma of a stuck relationship into the next world.
That's great. Yeah, quotation the Buddha that bounces in my mind a fair amount. He says, there are many who do not think they will actually ever die. Then he goes on, those who do know that they shall one day die, settle their quarrels.
Yeah, very
like that. As best they can, if only inside their own heart. Yeah. Yeah. Please.
I just feel that when she was talking about the coral, or species that are dying.
Yeah.
Because of us.
Right.
And you know, there is, for me, there is grief and pain around that, you know.
Yeah.
I cannot sit, meditate, and accept without feeling the sadness, the pain, and the grief, you know. And out of this combination may arise an acceptance.
Do you, if I may ask you, and others may be reflecting on it, what do you find is the difference for you, let's say in that, where you open your heart and you naturally feel the grief, and a sense of, maybe, I do, complicity as a human, as an American, who consumes a lot of resources, so forth. How do you distinguish between the first dart of that natural, appropriate grief and other reactions too, from where it feels like you're going overboard? You're getting into second dart territory. Do you explore that distinction yourself?
Into second dart territory.
Right? Yeah, where I'll say it for myself. Mm-hmm. Like, I think about refugees in the Middle East, mm-hmm. And I start the weight of it, the pang of it. And I think that's, in my opinion, moral. And I think that's consistent with Buddhist teachings, to have a heart that's so big. Of compassion means to suffer with. Compatio, it's bittersweet. It's sweet, there's lovingness, but there's bitter of wow. You know, and I've been on the receiving end of compassion without empathy, which feels pretty hollow and superficial. People who, you know, kind of wish I weren't suffering, that's the compassion part, but they couldn't be bothered to really let my suffering land, in some sense, empathically on themselves. So let's say there's real empathy. But then I notice in my own mind, sometimes I'll start getting into a complex narrative about it, you know, the history of the Middle East and who I think are the good guys, who are the bad guys, you know, all that. I start working my way up into anger. I start having these fantasies that are completely grandiose of being able to just fix everything. And then I notice, whoa, wait a second here. That's for me second darts. I'm throwing those myself. Right. It's not helping, and it's adding to my suffering, and it's actually making it harder for me to be constructive.
So that is kind of dramatization, whereas the first that we talked mm-hmm. about is the immediacy of the response when yeah. you get some news or when you see yeah. animal suffering
yeah.
or refugee suffering.
Yeah.
So this is kind of the dramatization going on in the story?
Yeah, that would be, for me, one characteristic of a second dart. You know, inappropriate self-blame, like I should have done something different during, you know, the run-up to my father's death. One thing that I'm dealing with now is my family system, someone I found has taken issue with me about something and I had no knowledge of, and I still don't know what the problem was. So, you know, the first start is to feel the pang of that cutoff, in effect rejection. I've tried to figure out, to some extent, plausibly, what could have happened, and I've written letters of apology that are at the upper bound of what I can possibly imagine truly has happened, to no avail. But after a certain point, rehashing and reworking it, and you know, it doesn't add anything to me. And then what actually helps more is to just, frankly, be at that peaceful place, you know, whatever is true for you over there, what's true for me over here is I still love you. And it's so much out of my hands. You know, and a rich topic. I think we're going to keep going on this one, right? In the future. We're going to wrap up really, really soon. If it's okay, just because I don't think I've ever taken a question from you or a comment, maybe we'll finish with you. Is that all right? And I'll happily stick around here too. But I'll stick around over there because that's where I'm supposed to be. All right. Yeah.
I'm relatively new to this.
Yeah.
When I hear what you were saying about how people practice saying goodbye and realizing they may not see each other and there's
yeah.
I understand it intellectually, but I don't really know what the practice would be to
yeah.
really own that, because I know when I've tried to do that, like in I took a child development course and
yeah.
I had some Buddhists and they had us sit there and think about the impermanence of everything and then the impermanence of our child. All that came up for me was such intense emotion that I had shut down. So
yeah.
I guess maybe it's a big question, but what are the steps of the practice of it not being an intellectual knowing, but just...
Oh, I'm so glad you brought it up, and I think those are always the right questions, you know, in the practice. Like, what's it really about? And as a detail, my own experience of being around monastics, not just Buddhist monastics, but other monastics, people who are really dedicated, most of what they talk about is not theology. They talk about practice. that's where the rubber is meeting their road, right? So my friends were pretty mature in their practice. And they were, first, they had fully received the love of each other and fully given their love. Bingo. One. They had really received and let it land, you know, what was there to receive, and they felt like they had not held back. They were not waiting for the next battle, you know, holding something just in reserve. They had really laid it out there. And I think that made it authentic rather than merely an interesting idea. That was one. The second thing is, I think it's mostly true, and I knew them both quite well. One of them actually recently did die quite suddenly and shockingly. And I was at the memorial there. And they repaired in real time. A lot of people talk about don't go to sleep angry, you know. Or if you're going to go to sleep angry, repair before you leave in the morning. You know, repair before you're done with breakfast. You know, if it's better to repair after you've had a good night of sleep and a meal, okay, but right away. So they didn't have anything unfinished. I think that's true. And I think the third thing that's very real, and it goes to this broader point that I'll speak to, is where you just realize that the truth is, like you were saying, we're just local threads or little knots or a patterning of the tapestry altogether. And what governs what happens is vastly, mainly outside of our control. Accidents, strange events, you know, people come into our lives, people pass out of our lives, you know, and there's just a kind of ground of growing acceptance of that fact, coming to terms with it as a reality, feeling the first darts about it, right? Like I'm a total geek, I'd want to be around for at least 10,000 more years because I'm curious, you know, even longer. The old joke, who wants to live to be 100? Someone who's 99, you know? And it's, but in a deep way, we come to peace with it if we can. And then on the basis of that, we recognize that how can I put it? There's no difference between our nature and the world's nature, or their nature. All that is subject to arising, as the Buddha teaches, is subject to passing away. All that has appeared will eventually disappear, you know? And that's reality. And so if you are already grounded and pretty okay with that reality, then when there's a local reminder of, oh, this could be the last time we look at each other, then it's not so shocking or horrible. It's more like, oh, and then it takes you into something loving and peaceful. How about we sit for a minute and then we'll finish up. You all. presence amidst impermanence. Take care. See you next week.